Intermediate Cartography by Whimsical Images, read by Marianas. On market day, an extremely downtrodden-looking cat trails in after Costas upon his return from one of his excursions into the green hills of Roa. The cat meows loudly enough to startle Comet from his letter to Relius, which he's trying to finish before the light fades. He lifts his pen so that the ink doesn't blotch and turns to face the cat. The cat stares at him, then solemnly puts a paw on his foot. "She followed me home," Costas says, sheepish. Comet looks up at him and frowns. He must not have gone far today if he didn't take any weapons. The freckles across the bridge of Costas's nose grow darker by the day. It is even more distressing to contemplate than the freckles on his broad shoulders, which are mostly uncovered by his light summer chitin. Comet takes off his spectacles, a gift he'd found in his pack on the second day out of Atolia, with no note and only one possible source, so that he no longer has to see Costas's horrible shoulders, or worse, his face, with any clarity. "I can see that. You've probably deprived some poor farmer of his mouse catcher," he says, nodding at the cat. "She's free to leave if she wants. I don't even know where she came from," Costas says. Comet, who knows that Costas both regularly sneaks food to the stray dogs that lays about the square of the little village nearest the temple, and has named every single one of those dogs, raises his eyebrows. "I didn't give her anything," Costas protests, "though she may have seen me catching fish." Comet hums. "A cat is a good companion," Costas says. "At least it's not a lion cub," replies Comet. The other scribes and scholars at the temple are mostly from Faerie, and Comet finds real joy in discussing the work they do. Faerian isn't one of the languages he speaks fluently, but many of the temple workers speak the Aetolian of diplomats, rather than the rolling Roan dialect, which is more difficult for him to parse. They call him Kay instead of Comet, but it's an acceptable alternative, since they also know him as a free man. Comet makes friends and learns about Faerie and watches the sea when he can, and then he comes home to Costas, red gold from the sun, and thinks that he would be perfectly content to spend the rest of his life this way if only the gods would allow it. He was going to be the right hand of an emperor, and now he is disgustingly happy translating scrolls and keeping house with an Aetolian soldier. It's abominable how much he doesn't mind. The next suspiciously domestic occurrence sees Costas bursting through the door with an armful of branches, grinning. The cat, which Costas is taking to calling Onarka for her tyranny, looks displeased at this turn of events. "Arla in the village let me take some cuttings from her olive trees to plant," Costas says, clearly proud of himself. Comet, who can track down a discrepancy in crop yields, or troop numbers, or taxes in his head, who can speak 5 languages fluently and another 2 enough to get by, is admittedly a little mystified by the entire process of growing things. Of course, he could rattle off any amount of information about the historical importance of olive trees to the Aetolian economy, but all he really knows about the plant itself is that it produces olives. "We will have fresh olives," he hazards. Costas smiles at him, and Comet quietly seethes as a rebellious warmth fills him. "Not for a while. Even from cuttings, olive trees take a few years to fruit." "We will have a tree," Comet clarifies. "We'll have a tree," Costas agrees. "This soil should be good for it." He sees that Onarka is still eyeing him warily, and shakes the branches at her until she backs up and all her fur stands on end. "Stop taunting the cat," Comet says. "It's beneath her dignity." "Her dignity? I knew you liked her," Costas says, turning away. He's triumphant and, as usual, irritatingly correct. This whole thing, Comet reflects, wouldn't be such a problem if he didn't know that eventually it must end. He allows himself a deep breath and goes back to his translations. Mirai is the only woman from Faerie in the temple, though there are several Roan women. Comet has heard that the Duke of Faerie allows her primarily because she is his cousin and a favorite. "Kay, will you come to the summer festival tomorrow?" she asks him when the leaves are first touched with green. Not being Roan, Comet hadn't thought he was invited, but Mirai isn't Roan either. "I hadn't planned on it," Comet says. "Plan on it, then. Arla told me to come, and she said nobody would look askance if I brought Philomena, so you should bring your friend, too." The way she says friend makes it clear that she means something completely different, but Comet doesn't have the heart to correct her. Perhaps this Philomena is the real reason she's not in the court of Faerie now. Something as simple as love is never easy for people like them. It always has a cost. She begins tapping her foot. Well, she prods him. Come, you've been here for enough time that you've been adopted by half the village. And your friend never visits you at the temple. I want to meet him, Kay. He's usually out hiking and collecting plants, Comet says. She frowns at him. I'll come and I'll ask him, Comet agrees. He's planning on doing neither, but when he gets home, Custis is already there and doing something complicated with a handful of periwinkle wildflowers. He looks up at Comet, eyes crinkling at the corners as he smiles. It's terrible. Huron told me when I was buying chicken that we ought to go to the festival tomorrow, Custis says. Comet makes a noise of assent. Mariah at the temple told me the same, he says, though she didn't mention anything about flowers. Custis looks down at his hands, but Comet sees a trace of red on his face. At the spring festivals in Atolia, most people wear flowers. Comet had not attended any festivals in Atolia, as Nahusaresh had meticulously avoided as many social obligations involving the peasantry as he could while still maintaining good diplomatic standing. But Eugenides, in his guise as the errand boy, had gone to more than one, and always returned laden with flowers and honeyed figs and nutcakes, which he generously bestowed on any unfortunate mead secretaries lurking in the palace kitchens. Tell me about the festivals, then, Comet says, without really thinking about it. He would say almost anything for Custis to keep looking at him like that. The smile sneaks back over Custis's face like ivy. Comet feels it in his chest. By the next day, Custis has convinced him to put the periwinkle in his hair. Comet would feel wildly conspicuous if everyone else in the temple weren't also bedecked in flower garlands, courtesy of the Rowan scholars. Periwinkle, Mariah says knowingly, when she walks by him, trailing her own daffodils. It sets off the gold in your eyes. Months pass, and the cuttings do not sprout, despite Custis's careful watering and hovering over them, and Custis mopes about dejectedly while pretending that he's not disappointed. You could ask Arla for advice, Comet suggests. I grew up on a farm. I know how to grow an olive tree, Custis replies. Also, I try not to ask Arla for advice about anything. This is wise. Arla is not only the village matriarch, but also the village gossip, and Comet has heard her declaim at length about everything from the state of the weaver's new fabric to the romantic affairs of the temple workers. He is endlessly grateful that he skirted her notice so far. If war comes to Roa, Arla will know about it even before Comet, and will likely give any invading army enough of an earful to buy a few extra hours before any fighting breaks out. Asking her for advice is asking for a 3-hour lecture over vile herbal tea, as both of them have learned the hard way. Comet shakes his head. Your experience is failing you? Custis narrows his eyes. The tree will grow. Anarka meows a confirmation, and Comet shrugs and absently scratches under her chin. 3 weeks later, Custis drags Comet outside to see a tiny sprout emerging from the soil. Comet refuses to look him in the eyes. He may already be a doomed man, but there's no need to make it worse. 3 years and we'll have olives, Comet, Custis announces. So, Comet says, not pointing out that planning 3 years in advance seems like a pointless exercise when the war will take Custis away far sooner. Make sure you get extra for that cat of yours, Huron the Butcher tells Comet in late summer when he's making his weekly purchases. She's not my cat, he says. Huron squints at him. Then get extra for the cat which is not yours but lives in your house, he says. Comet, knowing when to accept defeat, silently pays for more. Sometimes Comet will turn from his writing, or walk through the door, or look out the window at Custis fussing around the tree, and Custis will be looking back at him. It's not expectant, but speculative. Custis isn't asking for anything outright, but waiting for Comet. Custis is far too kind and patient in general, and he doesn't seem to realize he's driving Comet slowly insane. Comet can't bring himself to ask. Both of them know that something is growing here in Roa, but Comet can't name it. He refuses to. Once you name a thing, it becomes very difficult to let it go. How are you to earn your keep, then? Comet had asked, a bare handful of weeks into their stay in Roa. He sent me off with a full year's salary, and a second waiting for me here, Custis had confided. Every new piece of information Comet had learned about the king seemed to serve only to increasingly confound him, but he hadn't pointed out how eerie it was that Eugenides had prepared far enough in advance as to leave a significant sum of money for them in Roa before their arrival. Costas had surely already known. Once more, Comet had tried to reconcile the serious king and the errant sandal polisher in his head, and failed. "The king of Aetolia is generous," Comet had murmured. "My king knows that Roa overlooks all the best sea routes for the Mede navy to attack the little peninsula," Costas had corrected. "And you are his favorite," Costas had eyed him, amused. "Don't worry, Comet. I'm sure you're near the top of the list. It seems the king of Aetolia enjoys overturning the lives of those in his favor. I myself am glad of it." A pause. "I am as well." The year turned, summer passing into Roa's mild winter and back again to spring. Costas finishes charting the land around them and acquires a horse to begin making more distant trips, though he's never gone for longer than a month. He copies and recopies his maps in careful detail and passes them to a string of nondescript Aetolian sailors on the trading ships. He waters the olive tree on a schedule Comet can't parse, and he feeds the cat too many times a day. When Costas leaves for more than a week, Comet is made to feel like a miser by Anarcha's constant plaintive yowling, despite Huron's assurances that a farm cat should only eat a certain amount. Comet makes translations and watches the ships dart in and out of the bay and allows himself to very quietly love Costas, wondering when this life he has carved out will tumble down around his ears like a poorly built house. "You worry forever," Goedeker had said. "You'll never feel safe." Comet had heard the truth of it, even then. He wishes he couldn't feel the war on the horizon coming to take what it can from him. He may keep his life, his scrolls, the temple and the friends he has made there, but there's little chance he can keep Costas. Even good kings, and kings who aren't so much kings as thieves, need soldiers to fight their wars. Costas is a soldier still. Comet repeats this to himself, hoping it will make things easier, and knowing that it will not. Later, when they had been living in their cottage in Roa for close to a year, Comet dares to ask, "Can Aetolia survive?" What he means is a whole litany of things which they both know. War is coming, unless the tension can be diffused beforehand, and Aetolia will bear its brunt. The only hope for the little peninsula is a short war, and Mede tactitions are experts at long sieges. Costas will leave, as he must. Routing the navy at Hemsha had angered the Emperor, but Imperial gold could buy as many ships as necessary, and Aetolia would need all her troops. Comet will relearn a solitary life. He's asking because he wants to hear Costas' unshakable faith. It gives him a candle to hold against his own morbid certainty that the Medes will overrun all Aetolia, Edis, and Sunis, and Aetolia's beautiful gardens will be razed to the ground as punishment, and the brilliant young king and queen will die with them, and Costas will die in their defense. "You were in Aetolia when the Sunisian navy burned," Costas says. It isn't really a question, but Comet nods. "Sunis blamed Aetolia, Aetolia blamed Edis." "My king burned the navy," Costas says. "He went himself to steal the Magus of Sunis after convincing the courts of all three countries that he was out of favor and still recovering from the loss of his hand. He was ill, but I think he knew then that Medea would invade sooner or later, at any cost. His plan began with burning Sunis's navy and ended with chasing the Medes off Aetolia's shore, and on the way he convinced Aetolia to marry him." Comet should doubt this as too far-fetched to be truth, but he does not. It's not the story told in the Empire, but most stories told in the Empire discount the king of Aetolia as an imbecile, and Nehusarish had done his level best to make Aetolia herself out as a villain who had taken advantage of him. This was one of the tales Nehusarish's wife had been particularly unhappy with. "You think he can outwit them?" Comet asks. Costas considers the question. "I think he has spent some years ensuring that the Emperor thinks him a fool, and I think anyone who underestimates him eventually pays for it in blood." He shrugs. "I cannot say what he will do, since I am not a tactician or a strategist, and he is both." "You are not simply a soldier." "I am a soldier, though I am not simple," Costas allows with a smile. "And I trust my king. He will make sure Aetolia comes out on the other side of this." "I hope you are right," Comet says, and realizes that he does. Aetolian ships dock at Roa's port once a month, and three times a month from the Greater Peninsula, ferrying scholars to and from the temple. The Medes pass through rarely, and Comet avoids them, but he takes care to befriend sailors from the other ports, especially younger ones with worse jobs. Few slaves end up on the trading ships, but many indentured do, and they're the ones he knows have the best information. With the spyglass, he could see a navy coming, but he'd rather know in advance. Today, the cabin boy from the Narren's Dawn is unusually nervous as he hands Comet a letter, and Sunset finds him trudging home with a message he doesn't want to deliver, and a thousand reasons to hide it away. Costas is pruning the olive tree, looking entirely at peace, while Anarka winds around his ankles and makes a nuisance of herself. Comet stops a few steps away, memorizing the angle at which the sun hits Costas's hair, the dirt on his knees, the comical face he makes when he's concentrating. He feels faintly ill. He feels like he would trade every precious scroll in the temple for another year. Even, maybe, for another month. "Are you going to give me the bad news, or should I guess while you stand there?" Costas asks. Comet thinks for half a moment more about lying before finally dismissing it. Trust is a fragile thing. "You've a berth on an Aetolian ship leaving harbor in the morning," he says. "The skirmishes between navies north of Zebrisa have become much worse, and the Emperor is planning to invade in late summer. The yeomen from the Ferian ships say there are rumors of a Mede-instigated plot against the king and queen in Aetolia City." "The king has called me back. I need to be there to protect them," Costas says quietly. Comet exhales. "So," he says. "I leave in the morning, then," Costas says. Comet closes his eyes, tries not to rock back on his heels as if punched. A hand on his shoulder makes him look up and meet Costas's eyes. He looks serious and concerned and very, very beautiful. "Comet, keep yourself safe while I'm gone. And run if you have to. I don't know whether the war will come here, but I'd rather you stayed alive if it does, and you're still shit with a sword." "The war won't come here," Comet says, indulging the urge towards contrarianism to try and stifle the threatening despair. Costas frowns at him in consternation, so he gives in and continues. "But I will do my best to stay alive, so long as you do the same." Custis touches their foreheads together briefly. "I will." After Custis leaves, Comet's friends at the temple prevent him from becoming a shut-in, despite his best efforts. He means to ensure they don't realize anything has changed, but something about his demeanor must be obvious, because they are forever pestering him about meals and scholarly discussions, and it is so much easier to play along than to go home to a house empty of anyone but Anarka. "Kay, are you all right?" Mirai asks, when he spills his inkpot for the first time in months. It sounds like she's been asking the same question for several minutes. She touches his elbow when he doesn't respond, worried eyes scanning his face. She reminds him vividly of Layla in that moment. He shrugs her off and leans down to write the inkpot. "I'm fine." She crosses her arms. "I saw him leaving on the ship to Aetolia last week," she says, hesitating only briefly before barreling on. "If Philomena left to fight a war for Feria, I would be unhappy." "I'm not unhappy. It's not nice to lie to your friends," Mirai says. "All he does is lie to his friends," Comet thinks. "His presence here is built on a lie to his friends." He avoids her gaze and instead looks down at the ink he spilled on the floor. He'll have to fetch a cleaning cloth. He'll have to get more ink sooner than he expected. Mirai isn't leaving without an answer, though, it seems. "I really am fine. I've just forgotten how to be alone," he says at last. Mirai sighs. "Okay. Nobody ever really learns." Some of the fighting is visible off the coast, and Comet can only feel grateful that Costas is likely in the Aetolian capital rather than on the ships that routinely limp away from combat in the Elid Sea. The trade ships in the Roan harbor grow rarer and then taper off altogether as Feria sends more resources directly to Aetolia. Ferian temple workers who had hoped to go home before the winter give up and dig in to stay until spring. Anarka sheds a great deal of fur and stays indoors without Costas rooting around in the garden to tempt her outside. Twice, Mede soldiers sniff around the village, but find nothing of interest besides the fresh fish and Arla's sharp tongue. Roa is not worth conquering on its own, and Comet's bearing camouflages him. It marks him as a free man among free men. The ice in the bay is just beginning to thaw when Arla pulls him aside on his way to the temple and tells him, "The Magyar traders have it that the Aetolians have won. They say that the Medes were tricked into firing on their own ships." She looks around and lowers her voice, even though nobody besides them is out so soon after sunrise. "They say that the Mede Emperor is dead, and there's a challenge to the throne keeping his heir occupied." Far be it from Comet to doubt Arla's network of informants, which surpasses even the one he's been cultivating. "Thank you," he says, slightly numb. She nods at him. "Your soldier will come back then? He always picked ironwort for my tea when he was in the hills, and I'm far too old to go by myself." "I hope so," Comet forces out, trying to reason with the painful wish living in his chest. If Custis yet lives and is capable of travel, it will be weeks before he returns to Roa, if he's returning at all. Even with the spring winds coming, even if he takes the most direct route, it will take at least a month. He may not be alive to come back, Comet tells himself. His mutinous heart, given the barest sliver of light, still sings. Weeks pass, and the first Aetolian trading ships in months make port at Roa, but Custis is not on them. On the docks, Comet curses himself for a fool in every language he knows, and only relents when a cabin boy passes him a note that simply says, "Wait for the spring festival," written in the royal chicken scratch. Comet sighs and makes his peace. It is another month before the first spring festival comes, and Mirai drops a garland of periwinkle on his head in preparation. Today, he does not spill any inkpots. For once, he is the first to leave the temple. He had been unable to concentrate on the scrolls because he'd kept glancing out at the bay, where two ships with Aetolian colors were making their slow way into port. The docks are lively with the trading season. Comet had been right, and the war hadn't come here after all, but the winter had been lean, and even the Rowans had lived on tenterhooks with only the Magyar caravans bringing in goods. People are glad to speak with traders and sailors now that the peace is known. Comet left his glasses in the temple and has to shade his eyes to see anything in the bright sunlight, and his stomach turns and turns with anxiety until the figure walking toward him resolves itself at last into Custis, grinning hugely and immediately wrapping his arms around Comet, heedless of the obstruction to traffic they present or the flowers falling out of Comet's hair. Custis is warm as a fire in the temperate afternoon. Somehow, Comet had forgotten. Comet makes himself let go first, holding Custis at arm's length and looking him up and down for obvious injuries. Custis's grin only grows wider. He has a new feather-shaped scar on his jaw that stretches with it. It doesn't make him any less handsome. "I hope you don't have a head injury that you're smiling like that," Comet says sharply. He's not so love-addled yet. "I'm just glad to be home," Custis says. The freckles on his nose remain devastating, Comet notes. "Home?" Comet manages to keep his voice steady on the word, but it's a close thing. Custis spreads his open hands as if he understands exactly what and how much he's offering. "Home," he repeats. "I," Comet says, and bites his tongue. He doesn't know what he was going to say, really. The problem is that everything he has ever felt is trying to claw its way up his throat. "Comet," Custis says, and then says it again. It sounds different in his mouth. "Comet, surely you knew. I planted you an olive tree." "You planted me an olive tree," Comet repeats, like an idiot. "I think it's still alive." "It wouldn't die so fast," Custis says. "Anarka missed you." "Anarka did?" Custis asks, incredulous. Comet sighs. "I did as well." "Comet, I'm sorry, I wanted to come back sooner." "I believe you," Comet says, and means it. "I didn't know, but I believed you when you said you would come back. Also, your king sent a letter." Custis shakes his head, rueful. "Of course he did." "I'm glad he did. I was worried," Comet admits. "It was very quiet here in the winter, and news was hard to come by."
So. "No maids for him to cook, then?"
"Don't be a fool."
"Not for me either," Custis says, lacing their fingers together and pressing his smile to Comet's cheek. "I'm all for the quiet life." The end.